From the Lynn DeGrand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 7th day of September 2022. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office today. However, we'll have an interesting policy discussion to begin with the industry relations and policy specialist from Syngenta, followed up by a conversation that the nation's farm broadcasters held with the Secretary of Agriculture a couple of weeks ago. Hear all of that right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We'll begin our policy discussions today by talking with Mary Kay Thatcher. She was, at one point, the policy specialist for the American Farm Bureau Federation and is now representing Syngenta. Let's start with domestic policies that impact producers directly and Syngenta, the other life science companies that are involved in the production of pesticides. What is the current situation with the Environmental Protection Agency and how it's been handling pesticides?
I think we have to be really keeping a close eye on those folks because, there's been a trend to really kind of move away from science. And I think a lot of concern about what's happening in the court system. And that very much may not be just separate from EPA. But, you know, whether we look at, well, it seems like everything happens in the Ninth Circuit Court out in California these days. So we look at that and we look at things like atrazine coming up. That's a big concern to us right now, where they've gone in and said, hey, you got to cut your atrazine rate. And they've sort of gone to the trend of, if you want to continue to use atrazine, you're going to have to do between 1 and 4 conservation mitigation measures. And they won't be easy. I mean, one of the opportunities is a 100-foot buffer strip. So, but I think we're seeing more of that. We saw it, as you well remember, just a year or so ago on Enlist One and Enlist Duo. But in the end, that didn't end up being imposed on too many counties around the country. Here we're talking about 70% of the corn and 70% of the soybean acres, sorghum acres. So a big difference.
What is the issue?
Well, this time I think they're more looking at what's the potential runoff. And that's why they're looking at, could you do conservation mitigation like more buffer strips or contour plowing or different things like that. So they've significantly lowered it. They've also gone in, and I think this really points to the idea that you have, we all have lots and lots of people in Washington who just don't know what a farm is anymore. And it's very true at EPA. I mean, they're saying you're going to lower the amount, you're going to do conservation mitigation, you can only apply 2 pounds per acre, you can't apply it if the soil is moist, and then the one that really kills me is if your local weatherman says it might rain in the next 48 hours, you cannot apply atrazine. Well, who in the heck is the local weatherman? And, you know, on my farm, I've had the local weatherman say for 3 straight weeks, it's going to rain today, it's going to rain. It never did rain, but that would mean I would be precluded for 3 weeks from applying something. So pretty big impact on farmers.
So this goes back to what U.S. EPA has done and what the regulations are, sounds more like them anyway, at least with dicamba and some of the environmental and buffer zone sides of it, but that was about it getting up and moving through the environment. This one, I suppose, is about water movement, just applying it in a different way, and from your perspective, I guess, not in quite a scientific way?
Well, certainly we had as recently as 2016, EPA themselves, as well as lots of other studies, came out and said, hey, we do not have a problem. Then the new administration came in and said, oh, we changed our mind. We do have a problem. So we're hoping they look at the thousands of studies that have been done and realize that scientifically, this is an okay chemical. We should not be doing this. Everyone, I think, is encouraging them to indeed, once the comment period ends early October, to do what they call a scientific advisory panel, where people not related to us, not related to the industry, not related to EPA, will actually stand back and look at all those studies that have been done and make a recommendation. because we think if they do that, they will make a recommendation that, hey, things are very safe.
A different subject matter, Farm Policy 2023 is coming up. Does Syngenta take a stance in farm policy issues?
Well, we're not going to be as influential as the Farm Bureau or the corn growers or somebody like that, but certainly there will be issues, whether it's on some biotechnology issues, whether it's on, you know, more broadband. Certainly we need to make sure that we're getting the broadband access out in the rural areas, and then it's not just going to rural homes, but also be available for tractors and combines as they move through the fields, et cetera. But I think in general, we'll be part of the large community of ag-related groups that will, you know, try to make sure that we have an adequate safety net, that we have a really strong crop insurance program, strong conservation programs, et cetera, and just part of a group that indeed will try to educate folks about it.
Since you mentioned broadband and the discussion about having it widely available at high speeds in rural areas for combines and tractors and planters, that's about data collection. Do you have a stance on where data collection is, should be, and who it belongs to?
Well, you know, just about everybody is collecting data right now, but we firmly believe the data belongs to the farmer. And I think that's something we're going to have to continue to watch for, because there are a lot of people who really can see the value of getting that data and selling it to others and using it. And so I think agriculture ought to be really, really strong on the, hey, we own our data. If I want to give it away, okay. If I want to give it away to my university, okay. If it can be indeed hidden enough that you can't tell whose data it is, I'm not really sure I believe that, but okay. But, you know, in the end, it's the farmer's data.
And finally, on trade issues, there are plenty of trade issues around the planet. Sometimes these are phytosanitary issues, sometimes the genetic modifications. What things are you concerned about?
Well, we'd certainly like to see more free trade agreements done. And I think this administration has been pretty good about wanting to go in and deal with sanitary, phytosanitary things, look at issues like countries saying, hey, biotechnology is not safe, et cetera. We're all for doing things like that. But we're quite concerned that this administration just won't focus on reducing tariffs. And other countries are indeed cutting deals. And so, you know, when two countries cut a deal with each other, it's almost always, part of it is reduction of tariffs. So if we're not doing any new trade agreements, we're going to be paying higher tariffs to be able to export our products. And we just aren't going to be as competitive as we ought to be. This is not new just to this administration. I mean, you can go back to 2010 and just see the reducing or the stagnant number of trade agreements that the U.S. has done compared to other countries. So we sure hope the administration will change their mind on that, be willing to do it, be willing to look at free trade agreements, send trade promotion authority to the Hill to get the Hill on board, et cetera. We still export 20% of ag products and 25% of the value of ag products in this country. So we need a strong trade agenda.
Is it better to have bilateral or multilateral trade agreements in?
Well, you know, either is great. I don't know if we're ever going to get back to multilateral when we think about like the World Trade Organization. I mean, I think they're putting up a valiant effort right now to get that going again. It just seems like it's going to be bogged down forever. But, you know, whether you do one-on-one trade agreements or whether you do a trade agreement with six or seven countries, you know, either one that we can move on would be fine. It does take a long time to do a free trade agreement with one country. Now, it probably takes less time than doing it with multiple countries, but when you do them one by one by one, having the staff to be able to carry that out is pretty difficult. So I don't know that, you know, I can necessarily say one is better than the other. It seems to me that multi-trade agreements can potentially move faster, and therefore we could have more benefit, but we'd be supportive of whatever can move down the pike.
Thank you.
You bet.
That was a conversation I had with the Senior Manager for Federal Government and Industry Relations at Syngenta, Mary Kay Thatcher. Now, let's turn our attention to a press conference that U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack held with the nation's farm broadcasters after the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act. The president of the NAFB, the National Association of Farm Broadcasting, Spencer Chase, led the conversation.
Spencer, thank you very much, and thanks to everybody who's on the call today. Before I begin talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, I think it's important to also take a look at what's happened over the last 18 months that impacts and affects investments in rural places. I don't think we've seen quite the level of interest and investment in rural America than we've seen in the last 18 months. Just consider the American Rescue Plan, resources now being provided to the Department of Agriculture that's allowing us to transform our food system, not the least of which is expanding processing capacity, helping existing processing capacity to be able to sell across state lines, new processing grants that are going to be awarded this fall. This is an exciting time, and that was funded by the American Rescue Plan. Then there was the bipartisan infrastructure law. All that did was to provide resources for forest management to reduce the risk of wildfires, and also gave us the resources at USDA, the Department of Commerce, and the FTC to expand broadband access, high-speed internet to all parts of rural America. Just the CHIPS bill that was recently passed by Congress, when you say, well, what's that got to do with rural America? Well, precision agriculture, all those tractors, all those combines, all those farm implements that have computer systems in them require those microchips. And now we'll have an opportunity as a result of the CHIPS bill to ensure that those microchips are going to be produced here in the United States. That's going to produce manufacturing jobs. Many of those jobs are going to be located in rural communities. The Ocean Shipping Reform Act, basically addressing the issues of unfair practices by some of our ocean carriers, which will allow us to assist in continuing to expand on our record level of exports. And now we've got the Inflation Reduction Act. This is a historic piece of legislation in terms of the investment it's going to make in rural communities across the United States. Let me focus specifically on USDA's portion of this. The IRA is going to provide USDA with nearly $40 billion that will be invested over the next 10 years to improve life and livelihoods in rural communities. Now, when you combine this with all of these other acts that I just mentioned, it really is a once in a generation, once in a lifetime level of investment. We haven't seen this level of investment, for example, in conservation since the Dust Bowl. What we're talking about is nearly $20 million being funded through this Inflation Reduction Act for climate smart agricultural practices on farms, ranches, and forested areas. Now, let me break it specifically down. In terms of where that nearly $20 billion is going to go. First of all, it's going to go into existing programs that farmers are acutely aware of and understand and appreciate. $8.45 billion of increased funding for EQIP. $3.25 billion of increased funding for the Conservation Stewardship Program. $1.4 billion of increased resources for the Agriculture Conservation Easement Program. $4.95 billion for the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, another $1 billion for conservation technical assistance, $300 million for conservation technical assistance focused on carbon sequestration, and additional resources for staffing at NRCS. All of that totals $19.45 billion. And as I say, we haven't seen that level of investment in conservation in probably since the Dust Bowl. What's this going to do? This is going to help nearly 300,000 farms and ranches across the United States implement conservation strategies on approximately 125 million acres of land. In addition to the conservation investments, the bill also provides $500 million to build out the biofuel blender infrastructure necessary to continue to increase the utilization of higher blend biofuels, and also provides additional tax credits to spur the sustainable aviation biofuel industry as it meets its target of 3 billion gallons by 2030 and 35 billion gallons by 2050. There's a significant investment in rural electric cooperatives. The challenge there is to make sure that rural electric cooperatives have the resources to be able to convert to more renewable sources. So this bill provides for $9.7 billion of resources to rural utility services at USDA for loans and grants for renewable energy, zero emission systems, energy efficiency at scale. And this is going to result not just in additional jobs, not just in cleaner burning and cleaner energy. It's also going to result in lower utility costs for Americans living in rural places. It's estimated across the country that utility bills over time could decrease by as much as $800 per year per family. So all in all, a tremendous opportunity talk about the benefits of this bill. And when you put it in the context of all the other bills that have been passed by this Congress, it's really a truly historic opportunity for rural places and rural people. Let me stop there. And Spencer, I'm happy to try to take a question or two.
Well, we appreciate that, Mr. Secretary. First person to raise their hand is Todd Gleason. Todd, if you can go ahead and unmute yourself and pose your question.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for taking time with the nation's farm broadcasters. A couple of questions, they're related. First, how soon will the conservation dollars be available, and do they come in tranches over that 10-year period? And secondly, does the legislation provide a mechanism to ensure it's not used as an offset for the dollars that could be allocated in the future, for instance, via the 2023 Farm Bill?
Well, actually, the expectation is that these resources are going to be put to use right away, because the bill does provide and breaks down by year the level of investment that will take place in EQIP, for example, or CSP. So the expectation is this resource is going to allow us to begin to whittle down the very significant waiting lists that we have for projects that require conservation resources, but haven't had a chance to do so because there simply wasn't enough in the regular budget. The beauty of this bill, and I really appreciate your question, it's actually the opposite of what your question might suggest, which is that conceivably, this basically creates a circumstance and situation where it could be offset at some point in time. The reality is this, I think, creates greater flexibility with reference to the Farm Bill, because it really does address in a very significant way the conservation resources. And so it creates greater flexibility for the drafters of the Farm Bill as they look at additional uses and needs within that Farm Bill that they may not have been otherwise able to do. With this resource in conservation, as significant as it is, it gives them a little bit more flexibility. So if you talk to Chairwoman Stabenow and others, you're going to find that she believes that this basically is going to be helpful in being able to fashion a Farm Bill that tries to address as many of the concerns as there are out there.
Well, and as we wait for another question, Mr. Secretary, let me pose this to you. It sounds to me, if I'm understanding you correctly, from an implementation standpoint, this conservation funding really does not, frankly, require a lot of additional effort, if any, on the part of USDA staff. It sounds to me like you're saying they've now just got a bigger pot of money to work with as they're allocating funds based on applications. Am I interpreting you correctly?
They do, but I think it's important to point out that it also provides for additional resources for technical assistance. You know, one of the challenges we face with reference to conservation programs is the ability to help farmers put the plan together and sort of design the plan and implement it properly. You know, that's one of the reasons why we made the announcement about nutrient management plans, where we're using $40 million of the Rural Conservation Partnership Program to spur more nutrient management operations on a regional basis. As part of that announcement, we also indicated resources are going to be made available to expand the number of technical service providers and to make it easier and more quickly to certify those technical service providers so that we can get them on the ground as quickly as possible. We're also trying to increase the NRCS workforce so that we have more boots on the ground. I just had a round table meeting with Senator Bennett here in Colorado, and one of the concerns that was expressed by many representing farm groups was the need for continued investment in personnel so that people are there to help them in NRCS. And so we're on top of that, and we're excited about this new opportunity. So the good thing about this, Spencer, is it doesn't require us to go through a lot of rulemaking. Sometimes when you have a new program, you got to go through rulemaking and it delays the implementation. This is funneling into existing programs that everybody knows very, very well.
A change of subject, Mr. Secretary, just a little bit. You mentioned the Western United States. I'm wondering, given the USDA's involvement last summer with a webinar related to drought conditions in the Western United States, its expansion, the cattle industry has been suffering in that part of the world. Are there discussions within the agency about what can be done to ensure the beef supply in the U.S.? I don't know that that's a problem, but going forward, given the drought conditions there and the lack of water resources that might be available?
You know, I think we are obviously part of the drought task force. We're encouraging sister agencies to look at ways in which water resources can be conserved, water resources can be converted, water resources can be stored. And I think you're going to see a lot of action over the course of the next several years, which is really focused on this challenge at Western communities have. I think it's also incumbent upon us to look for ways in which, you know, the industrial use of water, use of water by just ordinary citizens, that we all are becoming very sensitive, not just in the West, but across the country, to the importance and preciousness of water. You know, it's one of the reasons why the money in the Infrastructure Reduction Act for forests may not seem like it's a water-related investment, but it, in fact it is. To the extent that you do a better job of maintaining those forests, they do a better job of conserving precious water resources. The bill, by the way, contains resources up to $4 billion in terms of some level of drought assistance and direction for the Colorado River area, so that it does specifically begin to address some of the challenges that that part of the country is currently facing.
If I could follow up just a little bit, anecdotal evidence here in the state of Illinois, especially the southern part of Illinois, where there would be more beef cattle production, and we're not a huge beef cattle production state, and that is coming from the western part of the United States, is that not only are the animals coming off pasture and moving other places, they're also being eliminated, and that the operators are not getting back into the business, that their intent is simply to get out of cattle production. I'm wondering how much of a worry that really might be, and if there's any other evidence that you've seen of this.
It doesn't surprise me that there are people thinking about getting out of the business. The reality is that's been true of agriculture for the last number of years. We've seen a consolidation and a reduction in the number of farms. It's a concern from the standpoint that we want to make sure we have people continuing to farm. It's a concern in terms of the aging nature of farmers, and that goes to a variety of ways in which we can help beginning farmers and young people get into the business and encourage them to get into business. But in terms of the supply, I'm not sure that we necessarily see at this point in time cause for concern that we're not going to have adequate supplies, both in terms of our domestic need and in terms of the level of exports that the rest of the world needs. I mean, we're excited about the opportunities that the recent announcement in Japan in terms of the beef quota presents for exports. It's a way of, I think, of increasing and continuing record levels of exports. So, you know, we're going to focus on equipping our farmers with the latest and best information and technology about how best to utilize water resources with reference to whatever operation they have. We're going to continue to hopefully encourage Congress to continue to invest appropriately in public research in agriculture, which has seen a sort of a flat line for a number of years. And we really need to, as a country, I think we need to get very serious about increasing the level of research funding. I think we're going to continue to look for ways in which the disaster programs can work most efficiently to help. And we're going to continue to make sure that we are flexible in the way we use programs in the face of disasters so that we keep producers on the land.
That was U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack in a conversation he had with the nation's farm broadcasters. You heard excerpts of that conversation here on Illinois Public Media's Closing Market Report.